This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of June 2018. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Austin's mayor and most of the city council go to West Texas.
Concerned about children that are being separated from their families and detained.
Texas Democrats hold their first convention since Donald Trump was elected president.
The blue wave now, after what we saw this last week, just reached a higher crest.
And an interview with the guy who just got sworn in as Austin's new police chief.
I'm also a firm believer in that policing is not something that can be done to a community, but has to be done with the community.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
You know, this standing of people in communities all across the country and all across our state has been about children and concern about children that are being separated from their families and detained.
That's Austin Mayor Steve Adler. He and most of the city council were in the border town of Tornillo, Texas this week. They were there along with the U.S. Conference of Mayors, which is a bipartisan group of city leaders from across the country, and they wanted to see firsthand the facility recently constructed to shelter children who cross the border either on their own or were separated from their parents after crossing. Mayor Adler says this week's executive order that ended the blanket practice of separating children from parents accused of crossing unlawfully was the result of a public outcry.
The only reason that there's been any movement, any measure of movement, is because individuals and communities have stood up and used their voices. The collective voice of individuals standing up has been really powerful. We're here as mayors to enhance or to magnify or give standing to that voice, and the executive order doesn't change that. People are now realizing that if they see an injustice and stand up, they can in fact have an impact. That is really important. It reminds us of our country at its best at a time when our country is acting in ways that many of us just don't recognize or understand.
Adler says they requested a tour of the Tornillo facility, but were told that their request would take 2 weeks to process. So the Trump administration's policy has changed pretty quickly this week. But as we record this podcast on a Friday, the president has signed an executive order to let immigrant families who attempted to cross the border illegally stay together. But at least 2,000 migrant children have already been detained as a result of the zero tolerance policy, which results in these separations. Now, as KUT's Saida Hassan reports, experts say the practice could lead to major mental health problems for the children.
Over his years of research, Luis Zayas has seen children develop attachment issues, lash out, and even go selectively mute after being separated from their families. Zayas is dean of the School of Social Work at UT Austin. His research has focused on U.S. citizen children whose parents have been deported, as well as migrant mothers and their children being held in detention.
In instances like this, we may see regression in behavior. An older child who regresses to more infantile behaviors, that's very common among children who have been separated from parents.
Zaya says the psychological damage being done to migrant children who are detained without their parents is twofold. Not only are they facing the mental strain of detention, but they're doing it alone, away from their families, with tremendous uncertainty about the future. Zaya says for many young children, the time spent away from their family feels like an eternity.
The young mind doesn't really grasp the sense of time, the concept of time, the way adults do. To a child, 6 hours could be 60 hours or 6 days.
Pediatricians have warned about the long-term health issues that can stem from the toxic stress children face in detention. And numerous medical groups are speaking out about the psychological toll it could take. In a statement released yesterday, the Texas Nurses Association said separation at a young age can lead to post-traumatic stress disorder. Paul Genfrido is the president of Mental Health America. The advocacy group released its own statement Tuesday condemning family separation.
We need to be able to make certain that we can put those children back together with members of their families. And then we need to make certain that we start today treating their mental health needs.
Genfrido says people have not fully grasped the extent of the mental health crisis being created by family separation.
That may be because we often think about mental health problems only after people are in crisis. So if 20 years from now, one of these children living in this country for a couple of decades then has a major crisis event, then we'll think about, well, what happened and what did we do and how do we, you know, fix that or change that post-crisis.
Saida Hassan, KUT News.
Donald Trump is threatening additional tariffs, this time on more than $200 billion of goods from China. And this is on top of import taxes that the president previously put on products including washing machines and lumber, steel, and aluminum. Well, as KUT's Jimmy Moss tells us, some of those tariffs won't be felt for a while. But some Austin area businesses are already feeling the effects.
For Westbrook Metals, they've been dealing with the effects for a few months now. Ever since the president made public his intention to put a tariff on metals.
When the tariffs were announced, we had an immediate uptick in price. Costs in general went up. And so we transferred those onto our customers immediately since we base our pricing off of market pricing.
Jack Fuller is the Austin branch manager for Westbrook Metals. He says prices haven't stopped going up.
People were buying out of fear of just, they wanted to get as much as they could at the current prices. So they loaded up on material. We saw a big surge in just business in general, and the cost just kept ticking up, the pricing for material. So those overall costs never slowed down.
Westbrook is a privately owned metal supplier. They have four branches in Austin, San Antonio, and Dallas. They order from larger mills, then they sell to smaller businesses.
Machine shops, fabricators, welders, food trucks will sell to breweries.
And in varying quantities.
We'll sell $10 or even less worth of material. But then today, I think we got an order for 250,000 that are going out. That's, you know, for one order for a big load of pipe.
And the stuff comes from all over the world.
U.S. as well as Canada, Mexico, India or Taiwan or Korea.
With the new tariffs on imports, mills in the United States have the cheaper product, but just by a little. On purpose.
They've raised their prices because they can. So they know that there's a tariff in effect, so the domestic mill raises it because why wouldn't you?
Tariffs on imports allow domestic producers to raise their prices on the stuff they make, which theoretically would allow them to reinvest profits into facilities and jobs.
The tariff gives cover for all domestic producers to raise their price up to the limit of the tariff.
This is Peter Rodriguez, the dean of Rice University's Graduate School of Business.
And in doing so, they become more profitable. They perhaps expand operations.
Expansion sounds good, right? Except the problem is higher prices for everyone.
The logic of the trade war is that everybody loses, and it's not likely that we're going to see any victories on either side here.
David Phillips is president of Jamar Roofing in Buda. His company has been putting metal roofs on Austin area homes for a few decades now.
Metal has been a very stable commodity for most of my time in the roofing business, as opposed to, you know, asphalt shingles, which have been very volatile.
Phillips' relationship with his suppliers helped stave off some price shocks, but now prices are climbing.
Our suppliers were holding their pricing for orders that were in place. And then, you know, after certain dates, they were taking the increase on and passing it through.
Which means prices go up for Jamar's customers. And Phillips says that's sometimes difficult to explain. So now he says he's redoubled his efforts with his sales staff.
The investment has always been significant to put a metal roof on a home. But now I think, you know, we're trying to just really convey the benefits and the advantages of metal so that price is, you know, a little more easily, you know, taken on.
Phillips is optimistic. He's ridden out price hikes with other materials, and he thinks the metal market will level off eventually. Back at Westbrook Metals, Jack Fuller is a little more cautious with his outlook.
The market is going to correct itself in some way, somehow, and whether that is a reduction in manufacturing, which forces us to relook at these tariffs, or whether it's higher prices for everything, and so we're just... I'm not sure exactly how that's going to pan out. I don't think anyone really knows, but it's going to be a little bit of a ride here.
A ride that will likely cost us all a little bit more to ride. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
This week, the largest school district in Central Texas passed its budget for the upcoming school year. But much of the Austin School Board's discussion focused on the money the district collects but won't be allowed to spend. KUT's Claire McInerney reports that half of the local property taxes collected will instead go back to the state.
It's all because of a state law called ReCAPTCHA. This law was the legislature's attempt to make school funding equitable across the state. So cities like Austin, that generate a lot of money through their high home values and local businesses, have to send a larger proportion of their tax money back to the state. Next school year, Austin ISD is losing $670 million. During the board's debate on the new budget, Trustee Ted Gordon said this ReCAPTCHA law, also known as Robin Hood, is unfair to AISD students.
This is not Robin Hood, this is piracy. We are being savaged by a state that is intent on punishing liberal Austin.
Gordon voted against the entire budget, saying he wants the board and district to re-examine their priorities. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
Three women are bringing a class action lawsuit against the city of Austin, the Travis County Sheriff's Office, the district attorney, and others, alleging long-standing systemic problems with how sexual assault is investigated and how suspects are prosecuted. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey explains.
This lawsuit is pretty sweeping. These women are alleging that female victims of sexual assault, both in Austin and the wider Travis County, have, quote, been denied equal access to justice and equal protection of the law. There's a lot of various allegations in this, one of which has to do with the city's long-standing rape kit backlog. They also just talk about the way in which these women felt like they were treated by police officers here in Austin, which is that they just felt like their claims were not being taken seriously. One of the sexual assault survivors in this case alleges that 5 years after she was assaulted, the Travis County District Attorney at the time, Rosemary Lemberg, finally indicted the man who allegedly raped her. But at the time, he was also facing charges in Harris County. And so a couple years later, the DA's office actually dismissed the charges against this man, saying that he would get justice in Houston, basically saying that, well, Harris County will handle this case.
The city of Austin issued a statement saying in part that the integrity of the criminal justice system is of utmost importance to the city and its law enforcement partners, and that the city will be reviewing the issues raised in the lawsuit as it determines its next steps. Texas is a deep red state where Democrats have not won statewide office since 1994. But this weekend is when the Democratic Party tries to get its grassroots members pumped up for the November election. The Texas Democratic Party convention is happening in Fort Worth with thousands of delegates in attendance, and KUT's Ashley Lopez is there. Hey, Ashley.
Hey.
So what is the purpose of the Texas Democratic Convention in Fort Worth? Why are all these Democrats gathered there?
Well, before every election, it's every 2 years, parties meet basically to just talk about how to win elections, like things they should be doing as they canvass and talk to voters and what issues they need to be tackling and, you know, also putting together their party platform, like what their stance is on a range of issues. So it's a way for the party to regroup every 2 years, especially before an election when it counts the most, to put down some priorities and some strategies.
And I want to ask you about those priorities in a moment, but I'm curious, this being the first Texas Democratic political convention since the election of Donald Trump, what the energy level is like when you speak with the delegates?
As you would imagine, everyone's just like really upset and kind of sad and freaked out. I mean, Democrats had a really hard election in 2016. They were all taken by surprise. They thought Hillary Clinton was going to be president and there was going to be a continuation of Barack Obama's policies. And instead, Donald Trump won. And he has a very different vision for America. And it's been kind of a shock to everyone. The sense of urgency here is palpable. Everyone seems to have this like deep desire to have a big turnout among Democrats so that there could be another change in the direction that the country's going in.
What are the issues that Texas Democrats are focused on at this convention?
Well, obviously, because of this week's news, immigration is a big thing that everyone's really concerned about. Democrats kind of stop short of having actual policy prescriptions, which is something I'm noticing. And then also there's a lot of concern over like economic issues like healthcare. Housing affordability has come up a couple times. Things that Democrats had been working towards during the Obama administration, they feel like we've been taking a step back. Others have been decrying the tax bill. They don't like that that bill has given a ton of breaks to people who are already wealthy. So those are the kind of things I'm hearing. But mostly, I see all of these conversations about policy as a way to get people to see the urgency of needing to vote in this election. And so a lot of what they're talking about are the things that we've been having discussions about for the past year.
Lots of Democratic elected officials there, members of Congress, members of the Texas legislature. Delegates get to meet in person, the kind of people they might see on TV or hear on the radio. Who's the biggest political celebrity at this convention?
Definitely Beto O'Rourke, who's running against Ted Cruz for the Senate seat. I mean, I've seen more Beto gear than basically any other political gear. You can tell people are really excited about him. He is the keynote speaker here. He's going to be coming in later, I heard, because he is voting today while he's in D.C. And, you know, he's still a congressman. But that's what everyone's looking forward to. He's like the big celebrity here at the Texas Democratic Convention. And I have some tape from a voter who is, that's what's kind of driving her this year. She's really excited to vote for Beto.
My name is Mary Lanalfi. I'm very optimistic. And the reason that I am is because literally Beto O'Rourke. I believe that he is such a strong candidate, and I've gotten really involved. He's gotten a lot of people involved. He's visited every city in the state of Texas, and I think that him being at the top of the ticket is going to pull up all the other candidates who are very, very good candidates.
I'm always curious about the merch at these political conventions, the merchandise, the swag. What have you seen so far?
Like I said, Beto's very popular, and so I think they put their most effort into their Beto swag. And I would say the Save by the Beto mug, like which is a play on Save by the Bell, where Beto is Zach Morris in this mug, is probably my favorite. Jury's out on what Ted Cruz is. He looks like he's dressed like Screech, but, you know, he doesn't have the Screech hair, so it could be Mr. Belding. We're not sure.
KUT's Ashley Lopez at the Texas Democratic Party Convention in Fort Worth. Ashley, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Buried inside Governor Greg Abbott's 43-page school safety plan is the potential for Texas to implement a red flag gun law. These red flag gun laws give courts the ability to remove guns from a person who is considered to be dangerous. Some people believe a law like this could have stopped the fatal shootings in Sutherland Springs and in Parkland, Florida. KUT's Alon Stevens reports lawmakers will start hearing testimony on the proposed law next week.
The idea behind a red flag law is simple: to give courts and law enforcement the ability to remove guns from individuals who are at risk of hurting themselves or others. Similar laws already exist in nearly a dozen states. About half of the laws were passed in the wake of the high school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Now, under a school safety proposal by Governor Greg Abbott, the House Criminal Jurisprudence Committee will hold a hearing next week to discuss how such a law could work in Texas. Representative Joe Moody, a Democrat from El Paso, heads up the committee. He and other lawmakers have proposed similar measures in the past with no luck. Now, in the aftermath of a school shooting, he says that Governor Abbott's plan may carry some momentum behind it.
Well, I think it says a lot that he's asked for legislature to look at it. That's certainly more of a conversation than we've had in the past. And the fact that he's placed it front and center along with other priorities, I think that gives it more weight, more credibility than it had prior to him doing that.
But such a proposal isn't cut and dry. When Rhode Island implemented its red flag law, the American Civil Liberties Union responded by saying that while the government has the right to create gun safety measures, the state needs to be careful not to overstep its bounds on individual liberties and due process.
One analogy other than tightrope is a balancing test.
That's Timothy Litton. He's a professor of law at Georgia State University.
And on the one hand, you want to balance the government's interest or the public interest, in this case, in safety, against, on the other side, what the deprivation of rights would cost the person whose liberty is being affected. And you want to also take into account the error rate or how accurate the procedures are.
Litton says there's also another consideration. Do red flag laws even work when it comes to stopping mass shootings? Well, that's hard to know due to federal bans on gun violence research.
So the answer is nobody knows the answer to that question. There's a lot of, you know, if you want to pass something, you're going to have to do something that is very experimental. There's going to be what, you know, for lack of a better word, the legislature is going to be shooting in the dark. And the reason is because the federal government turned off the lights on this question.
While the law's effects on mass shootings are up in the air, there has been a recent study showing red flag laws have a significant impact on preventing suicide. Debate over all of these considerations and more will begin Monday in a state that is staunchly pro-Second Amendment. Alon Stevens, KUT News.
One of the ironies of Austin is that its reputation as a city for music is one of the things that lures so many people here, increasing demand for housing, pushing the cost of living higher, and that makes it harder for musicians to survive in the city. So the city of Austin believes government has a role to play in preserving the city's music reputation. And joining us to talk about a couple of strategies under consideration is Chad Switecki with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor. Hi, Chad.
Hello there, Nathan.
What is this new tipping program being considered?
Well, it's a program that is likely to be rolled out in the fall, and we'd see it a number of kiosks from the company known as Dip Jar with a D. What you do is you dip or slide your credit card into these kiosks at what's going to be 10 tryout kind of pilot music venues, and you can tip a pre-selected amount to the band that's performing when you do your dip, and just slide them some extra money because you want to help them and support music in Austin. The music office with the city is in the process of rolling this out again for the fall with 10 kind of tryout kiosks, and then one would presume that if it's successful and no real hangups, that they'll look at possibly expanding it. So you've got the city buying these kiosks, they're going to pay the annual fee on them, but then everything else is going to the performers to put more money in their pockets.
So this would be at the bar, just so I understand correctly, or is it like a separate kiosk?
It's not even, calling it a kiosk isn't quite right. It's more just like a little module, like what it looks like is kind of stationed up against the wall, but it's I don't know, the size of a dinner plate maybe. Like it's not in your face and not going to take up a bunch of square footage.
So I see.
Kind of out of the way, but you know, you point people toward it and get them to do their thing.
So that's coming this fall to 10 music venues. It's still to be determined. What can you tell me, Chad, about this other program that would see the city of Austin offer financial assistance to touring bands here in Austin?
Again, something that's even more in the conceptual stage. What it would do is take a piece of the city's cultural arts division's capacity building program to increase the ability of artists to do their thing, which is basically a grant program. Typically, that's in the amount of around $1,000 or $1,500, but the music office is looking to up that amount to around $5,000, possibly as high as $5,000, to give selected artists and acts the kickoff money to launch a tour, because we all know that that's a risky venture. Sometimes it can wind up costing you money when you go out on tour even. So what they want to do is reduce that risk and make it possible for more Austin artists to get out on the road, grow their career, and do so without having to put their livelihood in danger, or at least their credit score.
One of the things that makes Austin so expensive to live, besides rising housing prices, is rising property taxes. And I can imagine critics of this type of program saying spending City of Austin money to subsidize small businesses, bands, is only going to further worsen the problem. What's the response to that line of criticism?
That line of thinking hasn't really come up yet, though. We're entering budget season for the city council after the summer break in July. So potentially that could be something that is kind of nitpicked. I mean, when you think about a $4 billion city budget, this is actually using existing city funds. So this isn't increasing anything that's already out there. It would be taking money that's already being routed into the cultural arts division. So this is all part of the city's economic development department. That's where the music office and cultural arts division both reside. And their charge is to, through different mechanisms and in different areas, grow the Austin economy. And we all know that the music economy here in Austin has an annual impact of something around $1.2 or $1.4 billion, depending on which measure you look at. So it's a way of incrementally getting more money in the pockets of Austin musicians, which is what the director there is trying to do more and more.
Chad Switecki is with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor. Thanks for your time, Chad.
Hey, thanks, Nathan.
Plans by the city of Dripping Springs potentially to discharge treated wastewater into Onion Creek have rubbed a lot of people downstream the wrong way. Now there may be a compromise on the table, but as KUT's Mo Bushell reports, that's not a sure thing either.
Ultimately, it's up to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality to give Dripping Springs the permit to dump treated sewage. So, a collection of groups and property owners located downstream of that proposed dumping are fighting the plan in a legal process called a contested case hearing. Dripping Springs says it's in discussions with many of those opponents for a settlement that would allow the permit to go through, but limit the city's ability to discharge the waste. Bill Folds is mayor pro tem of Dripping Springs. He says he can't go into details about a settlement, but in a general sense,
it allows for discharge in very limited situations. And if we were to discharge in a scenario that we don't address, at that point, we have to add more storage or more irrigation land so that it doesn't continue to happen.
But Fold says one group is not negotiating. It's the Austin-based Save Our Springs Alliance.
Save Our Springs is not engaging in settlement discussions right now.
Kelly Davis is a staff attorney with Save Our Springs. She says it may consider a settlement eventually, but right now the group wants to gather more facts through the process of discovery.
And in our experience, that can help parties come to the table and more easily reach a mutually acceptable agreement.
But not participating in negotiations comes with risks as well. Chris Harrington is an engineer with the City of Austin. Austin's long opposed Dripping Springs wastewater plan, but was not given standing to join the legal challenge.
These contested case hearings are extremely long and expensive, and they have an incredibly uncertain outcome. So a settlement agreement could provide surety, or at least some level of surety, in protecting the water resources from this potential permit action.
So what happens next? Mayor Pro Tem Bill Folds says Dripping Springs could reach a settlement with some downstream interests, leaving others to continue the legal fight. The TCEQ is expected to make its final decision on the wastewater discharge permit this November. Mose Bushell, KUT News.
Austin's newest police chief was officially sworn in today, Friday afternoon, but he's not new to Austin. Brian Manley grew up here. He graduated from Johnston High School and then the University of Texas at Austin, and he's been with APD since 1990. He's been interim police chief since former chief Art Acevedo left for Houston in November of 2016. Ever since the Austin serial bombing case wrapped up earlier this year, there have been calls by a lot of people for Manley to be appointed permanent chief because of how well they thought he handled the case. But there were also concerns raised by some groups about how Manley handled the case, especially when the victims of the first few bombings were people of color. Manley says he understands APD's relationship with some communities in Austin need improving. He spoke with KUT's Jennifer Staten.
Being the interim chief for as long as I was, a year and a half, and overcoming a lot of issues that faced us as a department, whether it was the DNA lab or having to sideline our police vehicles or the loss of the police contract, you know, we had a lot of critical incidents occur during the time that I served as the interim. I really felt like that I have more to give. And so, yes, my interest in being permanent, although I stated it from day one, I'd like the job permanently when they made me interim, it only grew as I got to continue to serve.
Your predecessor, Chief Art Acevedo, left Austin to become police chief in Houston. How would you say that your style or your approach to the department or to leadership differs than Chief Acevedo's? You're smiling.
I am smiling because obviously anybody that knew Chief Acevedo and knows me, there are very distinct differences. Where we share a lot is in our passion for policing, our passion for community policing, and really our love for the communities that we serve. I think that we are very similar there. Where we differ is just maybe in how we outwardly express that. I'm a little bit more reserved in my communication style than Chief Acevedo, as you may have noticed. In the parade, he'll be the one that's on the float laughing and singing, and I'll be the one walking and shaking hands. But again, the love for the job and the community is shared.
What are your priorities now as you move into the permanent police chief position?
The primary responsibility of the police department is to keep our community safe, making sure that we are utilizing our precious resources, our police officers, the men and women who serve this community to the best of our abilities in those areas where we're going to have the greatest impact on improving overall safety. I'm also a firm believer in that policing is not something that can be done to a community, but has to be done with the community. The work that we've done to build partnerships, both when I was interim and even before then, that work continues and actually is even more important now as we, you know, continue to try and advance policing, as we recognize the importance of these relationships. And another priority is just building those relationships where they don't exist, strengthening the ones that do exist, and making sure that we're open to community input.
What are the relationships that don't exist right now at the level you would like them that might be on that priority list for building and developing?
A lot of issues that were addressed during my vetting process when I would go to the town hall meetings as well as on my interview panels, you know, there were concerns that were voiced by members of the community and members of the activist community on either disparities in policing and the outcomes of the actions that we take, as well as just the culture of the department. So these are things that are important to me, and I will continue to engage with the community members that brought them forward and, you know, continue to hear from them to make sure that changes that we may consider implementing will address the concerns that they brought forward.
I know some specific communities who brought forward concerns and have been communities of color, and I'm curious if there's anything specific that you as chief or that you see the department being able to do to improve, strengthen relationships there.
Outside of just the work we'll continue to do to collaborate and communicate, there are specific policy issues that we're looking at. And one of those is how we handle low-level violations of the law. We look at the outcomes of those discretionary arrests and which communities are impacted the most. I see room for improvement. It takes a lot of time when an officer chooses to arrest someone, and that's why we have the cite and release program that we have. So I want to make sure that we're following that program in the manner in which it was intended, and therefore we should reduce some of the impacts that it has on certain communities across the city if we follow those practices when it's appropriate and feasible.
So I want to bring back some words that you said during that vetting process when you did some community forums with folks, kind of a vision statement that you laid out. Went like this. We want to be a department that is trusted and respected by all and that collaborates with our community to make Austin the safest city in America.
We have to have trust and respect if we're to be seen as legitimate. And the only way we're going to get trust and respect is through the relationship building that we're working on and ensuring that our practices are procedurally just. And then in collaboration with the community. We're real good at identifying things that we see as problems in the community, whether it be violent crime or property crime or the things that are just there. What we don't always understand are maybe some of those smaller issues that are really impacting a neighborhood's quality of life, but that might not show up on one of the metrics or things that we track. So we're going to work real hard to get feedback from neighborhood level groups that can tell us what's important in their neighborhood. So when officers do have discretionary time, time that they're not tied down to taking calls and working traffic, that we can make sure we're focusing on things that are important to that particular neighborhood or part of Austin instead of just what we think is important. And then the last piece really is, and I was told it was pretty aspirational and maybe not to put it in there, but I think it's important. And that's to be the safest city in America. If we're not striving to be the safest city in America, then we're not giving it our best.
There aren't a lot of people who know what it's like to be the chief of police of a major city. What is the job like?
You live with the concern that you have men and women. I have 1,908 positions in my department that frequently may be in harm's way based on the calls that they're sent to. We train them the best that we can, and we expect a lot out of them. So that's always in the back of your mind is just the safety of the men and women that, you know, not only are they part of your family, but you feel a strong sense of responsibility for. And then I have a community of almost a million people. And when you sit back and think that you really sit in that position that is not solely responsible, but has a really strong responsibility for the safety of all of those men and women who call our great city home, It is kind of an awesome responsibility, but it's one that I love. It's one that I've had 28 years to prepare for within the Austin Police Department, and I'm fortunately surrounded by a lot of police professionals that were all committed to working collaboratively to keep in our city the great city that it is and a safe city.
Chief Manley, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
That is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of June 2018. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.